It's Monday, March 4th. If Israel really wanted our food to get in, why can't we just drive it there? We start here. In an attempt to feed hungry civilians in Gaza, the U.S. military resorts to airdrops.
It is a fairly complex kind of planning operation for those Air Force crews.
It's cost a lot more money and effort than a simple aid convoy, so what does it tell us about the U.S.-Israel relationship? If you get COVID on a Monday, the CDC says you could conceivably be back at work on a Tuesday.
CDC in some ways is lining up with how the public is already operating.
We'll walk you through the new guidelines. And Oregonians fought to end the war on drugs.
These are not criminals. These are people with an addiction.
So why did this state rep just vote to recriminalize them? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. There are several reasons to start airdropping food into a war-torn country. One of the reasons is, of course, people there need food and can't get it in other ways. Like, if the government there doesn't want civilians there getting that aid, they might stop trucks at the border. Other times, the nature of the war is just too dangerous for aid workers to get through. Then, there are also moments like what we saw last Thursday in Gaza, when civilians are so desperate that the aid trucks who do show up get mobbed. So in past weeks, neighboring countries have said, we're going to start dropping food by parachute into Gaza. Some critics have said this is more of a PR stunt than anything, because you can't actually get much aid into Gaza this way. It's going to make it look like you care and potentially make Israel look bad. And for weeks, the only countries who have done this are ones who have aligned themselves with the Palestinians. Countries like Jordan and Egypt have made big shows of doing airdrops. Well, after last week's catastrophe in Gaza City, a new country raised its hand.
Innocent lives are on the line and children's lives are on the line. And we won't stand by and let until we get more aid in there.
On Friday, President Biden announced the United States will start sending food directly to Gazans via airdrops. By this weekend, tens of thousands of meals were in the air, and they have continued landing over the last 48 hours. Let's bring in Colonel Stephen Ganyard, former Marine fighter pilot, then a U.S. State Department official, now an ABC News contributor. Colonel Ganyard, why did the U.S. choose to start doing airdrops this way?
Well, part of it all comes back to politics being local, Brad. If you think about the heat that President Biden's getting from within his party to do something about Israel, and that do something means to help the Palestinians, to help those in Gaza who are suffering, much of it due to starvation. We've heard reports of babies being starved.
I have both publicly and privately counseled the president to use whatever leverage he has to try to get this long-term ceasefire.
So what he needs to do is find some way to not directly contradict the Israelis, but some way to get supplies and food and medicine into Gaza. And the easiest way to do that without putting troops on the ground is to airdrop. Now, is it going to make a huge difference? Is it going to be the kind and amount of aid that the Palestinians within Gaza need? Absolutely not. So there is some bit of virtue signaling here. But the amount of aid that will be eventually dropped will make a difference. Mm. There will be some enough that will be useful to the Palestinians that certainly could use it.
Well, and one thing I didn't realize was I was just picturing, like, you drop it anywhere and probably lands on roofs or in streets, but actually to sort of give people the most visibility, to make sure that the roof thing doesn't happen and somebody just starts hoarding it all, that this is actually being dropped basically on the beach, right? So, I mean, how do you sort of get this right in a way that keeps everyone safe?
Right. So there's quite a bit of planning that goes into it. You need to be able to say, we're going to put it here on this beach. We need to know what the winds are in the ground. We need to know how far it's going to drift. So there's actually compensation when you push it out the back to make sure that it doesn't drift into the sea or into populated areas. They probably are coordinating on the ground with relief agencies on the ground to make sure people are well back. But it is a fairly complex kind of planning operation for those Air Force crews who do this. And there's precision timing, because to think about something with a big parachute, you have to be able to put it in the right area that you want, probably within plus or minus 100 feet. And so being able to do that and understand how it's going to drift and how big it is and how much it weighs, how fast it comes down, these are all things that the U.S. Air Force and even Jordanian Air Force are quite proficient at.
Yeah, but I guess this is what I'm wondering, Colonel Ganyard, is this an admission that the U.S. doesn't think that aid can safely get in past Israel into Gaza, that the nature of the war that Israel is waging is making it so that the only way you can do this is with airdrops. I'm thinking about past airdrops. You mentioned some of them. We're trying to circumvent hostile governments like the East Germans, the Soviets, ISIS in recent years. We airdropped to civilians so ISIS couldn't get them. We're talking about Israel here. We're their biggest ally. We're seriously saying that we don't have enough leverage politically to do something besides just airdrops? I mean, what does this say about the relationship at this point?
Well, I think with the terrible events we saw last week with the aid convoys being overwhelmed and what actually happened there still be determined. But when you see things like that on the ground where you have desperate people who are running out of food, running out of medicine, people get desperate. We've seen it in Somalia before. We've seen it in northern Iraq, all these places where you have what are essentially humanitarian assistance disasters, where you try to drop food to them. And if you have people on the ground, that the likelihood of that turning into a riot and people, you know, getting trampled is actually pretty high.
This man saying Israeli tanks came out and opened fire on people randomly and directly, adding, if aid is to come to us in this way, we do not want it.
It's not just Gaza. We've seen it throughout the world, and that's probably why the president wanted to do something that didn't put U.S. boots on the ground, but making sure that some supplies got into Gaza.
Well, and so with all that in mind, I mean, where does that push the idea of a ceasefire? Because yesterday, like, we've seen President Biden say he was hoping for a ceasefire by today, which clearly has not happened. But yesterday at an event, Vice President Kamala Harris,
there must be an immediate ceasefire,
went pretty hard in asserting that, like, there needs to be a lot more done to get assistance into Gaza right now. So I guess I'm wondering, like, where does this put the idea of a ceasefire hostage deal in the days ahead?
It at least signals to the rest of the world, or the administration's trying to signal the rest of the world, that they aren't entirely beholden to the Israelis, that there is some sort of independence in how the U.S. looks at this. There is something here for the president to assert himself, and maybe that shows the Israelis that, hey, you are maybe a little more isolated than you thought you were, and we're not going to vote with your side every time. So is this aid going to make a difference, and is Hamas going to feel like we don't need to come to the table? Probably not. Is it going to help the U.S. in its negotiations? It might, because it shows the U.S. as being a bit more independent than it's been accused of.
Oh, interesting. That, like, it gives the U.S. that much more room at the table with other countries besides Israel. Although, in a statement, we should also add the IDF not only says it approves of these airdrops, it assisted the U.S. and Jordan in them, and also says Israel will be expanding its own humanitarian assistance as it continues this war against Hamas. Colonel Steve Ganyard, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, the CDC says the virus hasn't changed, but that we have the new COVID guidelines after the break. Do you take like a million photos only to let them sit in your phone or get lost in your files? Do you think you're going to look at them again? You'll never look at those again. What if you could put all your photos, though, from random camera roll pics to that high-res wedding album onto one gorgeous frame? You can with Aura Frames. Named the best digital picture frame by Wirecutter and The Strategist, Aura is nothing like the digital frames from a decade ago. Every Aura frame is thoughtfully designed to fit any decor style with a stunning HD display, unlimited cloud storage, and super easy setup. Simply connect your Aura frame to Wi-Fi and use the free Aura app to add endless pics and videos from anywhere. Invite friends and family on the app, and then you can have them comment, heart, and send new photos to your frame. It's like a real-life social network that brings you and your loved ones joy every single day. Speaking of joy, Aura frames make easy year-round gifts. Preload it with your favorite photos and even a personalized video message. Right now, you can save on the perfect gift that keeps on giving by visiting AuraFrames.com. For a limited time, listeners can get $20 off their best-selling frame with the code STARTHERE. That's Aura, A-U-R-A, Frames.com. Promo code STARTHERE. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Over the the last few years, we've all grown accustomed to what the CDC says you should do if you test positive for COVID-19. Immediately isolate yourself from other people. If you're at high risk for severe sickness, take medication like Paxlovid. And whoever you are, wear a mask around anyone else, including roommates and family. After all, they said, you're most likely to infect other people in those days after your initial symptoms. Back in 2020, the guidance was to isolate yourself for 10 days after a positive test. In late 2021, the CDC shortened that to 5 days. That, of course, was followed by the deadliest surge of this pandemic. Well, this past Friday, the CDC unveiled new recommendations saying you may only need to isolate for 24 hours after your initial infection. Mutations have made COVID less deadly, but even more contagious. So while this has been hailed in several states that had already issued this guidance, it was also second-guessed by some health and labor groups saying that this could help businesses by getting infected employees back to work sooner, but it might do so at the expense of public health. John Brownstein is an epidemiologist at Harvard Medical School. He's the chief innovation officer at Boston Children's Hospital. He's also an ABC News contributor. John, what are the new guidelines here? Like, if I get COVID, what does the CDC say I should do at this point?
Well, of course, we all have to practice common sense. Of course, if you're around those that are immunocompromised or elderly, you may change practice. But overall, the idea is we're trying to align with something that is doable as part of the mix of respiratory viruses that we are facing. And so the idea is you should definitely stay home if you're sick and if you have a positive result. But if those symptoms clear up after 24 hours and you're fever-free, you can resume activities. And I think for the most part, people are already kind of doing this already. So CDC in some ways is lining up with how the public is already operating. And you have to remember, we have most of the population already vaccinated. Most people already have the common sense understanding of what to do when they're sick. I think office policies have changed. We as a society have changed.
We wanted to provide folks an easy understandable way to protect themselves.
As CDC Director Mandy Cohen mentioned on Friday, you know, the idea here is that they are trying to create a guidance that is easy and understandable and reasonable to expect of the American public to undertake as we deal not only with COVID, but these other respiratory illnesses that circulate in the community.
We just need to remind ourselves, if you haven't gotten that updated COVID vaccine, not too late. We're still going to have COVID around. And also, as we get ready for the next winter, make sure you're already planning now for that updated COVID vaccine and your updated flu shot as well.
So CDC is sort of lining up with what is reasonable to expect from people as we deal with not just COVID, but flu and RSV and all these other respiratory viruses in the community.
And so one day after the positive test, or you're saying one day then after the symptoms subside?
So according to CDC, people sick with COVID can resume daily activities if symptoms are improving and fever-free for at least 24 hours without medication.
Well, and what do you tell those immunocompromised people that you mentioned earlier on? Because at this point, what these guidelines are essentially more lenient than what you would have if you were like at a school where head lice was there, right? You tell those kids to stay home multiple days after the head lice was acting differently, right? So what do you tell the many, many people that are high risk? Because there's a lot of categories for that.
Yeah, exactly. So we all have to practice common sense. And of course, CDC does put out specific points about those that are vulnerable. Of course, if you have someone that is elderly or immunocompromised, you want to be especially sure not to spread infection to those people. So in that case, you would still try to prevent any exposure over a 5-day period. You'd obviously want to be sure that you're wearing a mask, doing all the things that we've done over the last 4 years with COVID. And so we all know the practices that are required to reduce risk. And I think we know how to calibrate those activities based on who you're engaging with.
Well, and then I should also ask, where are we as a country in terms of COVID right now? Like, we've had peaks and we've had valleys, or are they all starting to even out? Or, I mean, what is the landscape of where we are right now as we head into the spring?
We are actually in a low period of COVID at the moment. We had a surge earlier in the winter. But as we have seen, there are multiple peaks of COVID every year, and they happen at different points in time, depending on the geography. And we have seen summer waves. So I think this guidance is well timed to a potentially newer summer wave and a new variant that we might hit. But overall, as over 95% of the American public is now has some level of immunity through vaccinations and, of course, through infection, we're dealing with a very different virus than we were, of course, at the beginning of the pandemic.
All right, John Brownstein from Harvard Medical School and Boston Children's Hospital. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, they were the first state to decriminalize these drugs. Now they could be the first to recriminalize them. One last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Cities and states have debated what approach to take to drug use. For years, it's been seen as a criminal issue. Use drugs, get arrested. But increasingly, local and state governments are treating drugs more like a health crisis. If someone's using, they need care more than jail time, is the thinking. At the front of this movement are states like Oregon. Well, recently, the Oregon legislature has said, okay, hold up, we went too fast here.
People are really upset, as they should be, that there's fentanyl on the streets and that people are overdosing and that we are having, you know, open sales across our city.
This is Maxine Dexter. She's a state rep from Portland, and she's also an intensive care physician. And she's describing what it was like in 2020 when voters passed an initiative called Measure 110.
Measure 110 was an effort by our Oregon state voters to elevate our addiction crisis to the public health emergency that it is, and to address it with a public health focus rather than a criminal justice focus.
What does that mean in practice?
It means that you don't arrest people for having a chronic disease of addiction.
As a result of this first-in-the-nation measure, Oregon expanded access to treatment facilities, set up ambitious call centers dedicated to people struggling with drug use, and decriminalized drug possession. I'm not just talking about marijuana. I'm talking about hard drugs, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, which used to account for more than half of drug arrests in Oregon. But a couple years into this experiment, not everyone liked what they saw.
Measure 110 passed in 2020, implemented in February of 2021. In 2021, more in the summer of 2021, is when fentanyl really started hitting the streets.
Dexter says she was seeing this in her own ICU. What used to be straightforward drug use cases were now becoming fatal overdoses.
I've seen more young people than I've ever had in a 20-plus year career. I had a 17-year-old who overdosed and ended up at a party just experimenting, and he thought he was taking a pain medicine, and it was an illicitly manufactured counterfeit pill with fentanyl in it. And when he didn't wake up, his friends thought he was asleep and didn't realize that he was dying. And that child did not go home.
What's more is lots of places legislate drug possession rather than drug use. After all, you're more likely to catch someone carrying heroin than injecting it. So the law says you're not allowed to carry heroin. But suddenly, with no drug possession laws on the books, no one had written down a law in, say, Portland that you couldn't shoot up in the park.
58% of voters passed the measure in 2020. Now there are different surveys, polls showing that the majority of Oregonians are very much in support of criminalization again.
On Thursday, the Oregon House passed a new bill that will effectively recriminalize possession of hard drugs. They'll be considered a misdemeanor worth up to 180 days in jail.
House Bill 4002A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed.
On Friday, the Senate agreed to this rule, and by the way, these votes were not close. They drew broad support from Republicans and Democrats, including Dexter.
This bill is really hard for those of us who take care of people and know that these are not criminals. These are people with an addiction, and I've seen it in 70-year-old women who break their hip and become addicted to pain medicine.
And you can hear in her voice, Dexter is conflicted. As a doctor, she doesn't see drug users as criminals, but as a public servant, she knows constituents want to see something done, which is why this bill has several carve-outs. For example, first offenses will still get you sent to treatment rather than jail. Records for drug possession can still be expunged. The difference now, though, is police departments will no longer be told to look the other way. They will push you toward treatment whether you want it or not, and some will be sent to prison.
It will be reinstituting the war on drugs against people who suffer addiction.
I simply cannot have faith that there will be an equal compassionate treatment given the history of these official anti-drug efforts.
There are holdouts here, especially Democrats in the Portland area, who say black drug users are more likely to be thrown into jail than a white person using a similar drug, which is why Dexter says she was hesitant.
We have people's lives who have been ruined for, you know, having possession of small amounts of marijuana before we decriminalized it. So we made an intentional investment to try to rectify some of that. And here we go again. You know, this is not going to be enforced equitably. We know that. That's just systemically, that's not
really happening. You're willing to like admit that right now, like this isn't going to work out fair for people.
So I do not know that. I am concerned that that is going to happen. And that is something the crafters of the bill are absolutely taking into account, and it will be monitored and reported.
All this raises the question, what role does prison play in drug use? Does the threat of being locked up have any effect, or is it just to make the rest of us feel better? If it's the latter, how do you weigh the needs of those drug users, many of whom are going through a terrible time, against the rest of society, where people just want to stop seeing overdoses on the street? Those are the questions that politicians, as part of their job description, have to grapple with.
This is not a unique issue to Oregon. It's just that we tried decriminalization first, and we're struggling with that.
As we begin the week, we still don't know where Governor Tina Kotek stands. She will have this bill on her desk today, deciding whether it's time for one of the most experimental states in the nation to end the experiment. And it's interesting, if we're talking about does jail make a difference, the CDC looked at Washington versus Oregon. Washington's overdose deaths rose quicker than Oregon's in the last year, and Washington has not decriminalized drugs. So those initial numbers from the CDC would tell you jail is not what's rehabilitating people here. Really complicated questions. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.